Would you join me in reading Hebrews 12, 1 through 3, tonight's scripture? It can be found on page 1193 of most of the Pew Bibles. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart.
After having prepared what was supposed to be today's sermon, a sermon that was going to launch my new series on the life of Solomon and the themes in the Old Testament that point to the coming of Christ, we, a week ago, last Sunday, were on a plane heading to a long-planned trip to Disney World, hence the tan. And we were determined, absolutely determined, because of the busyness of the prior month, to leave Boston behind. No email. I wouldn't check email. Wouldn't check my voicemails. I was just going to completely unplug and have quality time with the family in a place where dreams come true. But as you can certainly imagine, this past week, it was impossible to leave Boston behind. Stories and images of loss and fear found their way even into the Magic Kingdom. And so, upon our return Friday night, I had to postpone this sermon. In many ways, it's going to be just a series of reflections and an invitation for us to gather together as the people of God to pray. Now, I first heard of the bombing while I was waiting in line for a ride. My sister called me. She lives in Chicago, just checking in, giving me the update, which I had not heard about. And after I got off the phone, I could see other people answering calls, texting, or checking the news on their phones. Over the course of that Monday, I overheard people talking about the death of an 8-year-old boy. And the contrast could not be more stark. Because even as I was hearing those stories, all around me were swarming 8-year-old kids, mine included. And there would be no Disney trip for Martin Richards. And his parents would probably never be able to go to Disney without experiencing the searing pang piercing their hearts. Of course, there is the irony of the iconic picture of a smiling little Martin holding up a sign, "No more hurting people. Peace." The loss is absolutely haunting. And then, of course, there's the loss of Crystal Campbell and Sean Collier and Lingzi Liu, and the loss of limbs for scores and scores of other people. How do you make sense of these things? Certainly, there are a swirl of emotions that not only Bostonians, but people all across this nation, even around the world, have experienced: sorrow, relief, anger, pity, and many questions. Online, you can hear them. What could have driven these terrorists? How could God allow such evil? And many pressing needs, physical, emotional, spiritual. We turn to the scriptures. And if we're honest, and we want to move beyond the pious platitudes, we realize that scripture doesn't provide us a neat answer to the problem of evil. There's no tidy argument to the philosopher's objection to the existence of God because of the existence of evil. Sure, you can turn to the book of Job, but good luck. The answer there is often as perplexing as the question itself. And yet, Scripture does provide us ample reasons to trust God in immediate chaos, and a strong call to trust Him over the long haul. One of the first verses that came to my mind after I got off the phone with my sister was the verse at the end of chapter 16 of the Gospel of John, where Jesus is gathered with His disciples, and He is, well, He's basically promising them a lot of woe. You are going to experience problems. In fact, He concludes that section of His discourse in the upper room as He's trying to prepare His disciples for what will be utter chaos, a total disarray of all circumstances, the crushing of their hopes, and no possible resolution in sight. And Jesus says, I've told you these things so that in Me you may have peace. In this world, you will have trouble. I mean, think about that promise. I want other kind of promises from Jesus. But He says, in this world, you will have trouble. But take heart. I have overcome the world. As I mentioned, this is not going to be a full-blown sermon. It's really going to be a series of reflections to prepare us to spend what will be a time, maybe 10 minutes or so, of prayer as a congregation. Because prayer is the common language of the soul and is the common language of the people of God. Wherever I go throughout the world, if I'm visiting a country and have an opportunity to visit the church, I may not understand a single thing that's being said in the worship songs or in the sermon. But come time to the praying, there is this instinct of the soul that you know what is going on. The pouring out of our questions to God, our concerns, the reorientation of our attention upon God and His glorious purposes in life, purposes that we may not even understand the unfolding thereof. And a deep appeal to situate whatever circumstances we may find ourselves in, right, in the purposes of God. So I want to make just three simple points of reflection. As we seek to keep our eyes on Jesus, as we seek to follow this metaphor of life as a marathon. First, I want to deal with the fact that sorrow is real. But sorrow is a sprint, while Christian hope is a marathon. There is, in this lifetime, going to be periods of overwhelming sorrow. The adrenaline will kick in and there will be grief and the tears will flow and it will feel like a sprint for your soul. You will be winded by sorrow. It could be sorrow that you feel very intensely and personally. The breakdown of something in your family that you cherished and thought was going to be impregnable from trouble. A career that comes to a smashing halt. Some diagnosis that just is out of the blue. I mean, there will be sorrow. And it will be like a sprint that just catches you up and you're winded and you're grasping for air and you're wondering, when is it going to stop? And Scripture doesn't shy away from that reality. In fact, Scripture tells us God enters into that very reality Himself. Jesus. Jesus. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus. Now, all through the book of Hebrews, the author has one really basic point. He pursues it in some of the most theologically rich and complex Greek of the entire New Testament. But it really is a basic point. And the basic point is, Jesus is better. Whatever you got, the Jesus is better. And he weaves it through by looking at Jesus as the high priest, as the exalted Son of God, as the second Moses, to which all the law and prophets pointed. And so there are all kinds of names at this point that could have been used. Fix our eyes on the Son of God, on the Son of David, on the second Jesus, on the true Sabbath rest, on the high priest of the order of Melchizedek. There are all kinds of things that he could have invited us to fix our eyes upon some aspect. But he just chose the simple human name, Jesus. And I think it's very intentional to remind us that Jesus was in the race with us. He knows sorrow. We looked at this just a few weeks ago in the Garden of Gethsemane. That his soul was filled with sorrow. And he poured out that sorrow in such grief that his sweat became drops of blood. Can you imagine that level of sorrow and grief? It is beyond the grief of the dry heavings. After you have no more tears left and you're just heaving in sorrow and grief, Jesus' sorrow goes even deeper. And tears turn into drops of blood. Sorrow for this world, sorrow over its brokenness, sorrow that he who knew not a moment of disrepair in his relationship with the Father would soon be saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? I think the author of Hebrews wants to remind people, this is who we follow. We follow Jesus, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, as the prophet Isaiah foretold. But we focus on Jesus not just to be left in the Garden of Gethsemane of grief. We focus on Jesus to be brought through that, to the cross and to the resurrection. And so we fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, the Alpha and Omega of our faith, the one who is the champion and pioneer. This is not simply, the NIV has made a choice here by translating the author and perfecter of our faith. It's perfectly legitimate interpretation that is definitely a part of what's meant. But the word our is not there in the Greek. It's focused, fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter, the champion and pioneer of faith. He's not only the one who perfects our faith and brings us through life, walking with us in life, but he himself is a man of faith. He is the champion of faith. He had to exercise faith. In the garden, he had to come to the point of saying, not my will, but thine be done. He had to come to the point of praying his own Lord's Prayer. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And so we fix our eyes on this Jesus because the hope that we have in this life is a marathon. You will be winded by sorrow. We all will be. This past week, we have been kicked in the gut and we have been winded by sorrow. Jesus has promised, in this world, there will be trouble. But this world is not all that there is. And so we fix our eyes on Jesus, the one who endured and who ascended and sits on the right hand of the throne of God. Sorrow is a sprint, but hope is a marathon. And I can understand anger. But I don't understand the vitriol that sometimes gets spewed forth on the internet. Frankly, it's appalling. the amount of hate that could have precipitated this act of a terrorism, it stuns us. We ask the question, what could drive people to hate another so much? But frankly, if we are to look at ourselves with any measure of honesty, we realize that we run the sprint of hate ourselves. We have these moments of anger, outbursts. They seem to swamp us, catch us up in this adrenaline rush of indignation, most often indignation against what we perceive as a wrong or a slight. Something done against us, and we just lash out an angry word, hateful responses. Hate is real. Jesus knows this. Think about this. The amount of hate that was required to send Jesus to the cross. I think most of us, even toward the people that we are most spiteful, most of us could not take a nail and a hammer, lay someone down, look them in the eye, and proceed to slam it in. Most of us just couldn't do that. We forget because we are not there. We were not there at the cross. We forget this mountain of hatred that was foisted upon Jesus. What kind of hatred could get someone to do that? What kind of hatred could get a rabbi to turn over a fellow Jew to the enemy to have them do it? Jesus understands that in this world there's trouble. And part of that trouble is real hatred, real evil. Evil that is ugly. Evil that brings out the absolute worst in people. Evil that actually lurks in all of us. And that's the scary part. That within the heart of every person, there is that seed of evil that, given the right circumstances, would germinate into hatred. And what possibly can we do in response to such hatred? Love is a marathon. Jesus runs this race before us. He calls us as the author and perfecter of our faith to remember the joy that was set before him. What would enable Jesus to endure hate? It was love. For God so loved the world that Jesus said, greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. And you are my friends. It was this firm conviction that though hate may be a sprint that seems to overwhelm us, love is the marathon that will last into eternity. God is love. Jesus was sent in love. And Jesus calls us to love. And terror certainly is a sprint. The terror of injustice that we see out there, the potential terror of injustice that lurks in our own heart, when we see these things. And so we're called to the faith that endures. We fix our eyes on Jesus. We throw off everything that encumbers and the sin that so easily entangles us. Here, this image of throwing off the robe. Throwing off just your normal daily robe, which, you know, back at that time, because that was your clothing, it was pretty hefty. I mean, you would just wear this thing. And Jesus throwed off anything that would encumber you so that you might run this race with endurance. Notice, he said, not with speed, but with endurance. that step-by-step pursuit of Jesus. Jesus, who right now is at the right hand of the throne of God, this image of a God who rules. Yeah, evil is a problem. And there might not be real justice. Really, what kind of justice can we offer these families who have lost loved ones? Even if the terrorists were brought to tribunal, even if they were executed, in the end, would there really be satisfaction? Answers? The problem of evil may not be unraveled in this lifetime. In fact, I will tell you, it won't be unraveled in this lifetime. But stretching out for all of eternity is for us the faith that recognizes that though I may not understand now, one day it will be clear. It's like that Turkish rug. You look at it at one side and the back side is just this tangled mess of threads. You don't know where it's going, which way. And that's life. And in eternity, we walk to the throne room of God and God just turns it around. And we say, okay, that's the point. There's the justice we've longed for. There is the righting of the evil that we had hoped for. My final point, and this is to invite us to be praying together, is how this exhortation begins. Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. Now, in this metaphor of running, you would think the word that would be chosen would be the word that we use when we describe the Boston Marathon. Since we are surrounded by spectators watching us run. There are words like that in Greek. Here, the word specifically is for a witness. That word that we use, martyr. Those who bear witness even with their lives. It's as if the author of Hebrews is saying that in the Christian life, there are no spectators. There are only witnesses. There are only people who choose to get involved in the game with one another. Who bear with their own life testimony the truth that Jesus is the author and perfecter of faith. And so that's what I call us tonight too. To be witnesses. To be witnesses in the same way that Horatio Spafford was. The author of the hymn that we are about to sing. The one who experienced extraordinary pain. Who knew that sorrow was a sprint. Who had the anger of loss rise up within him, and who understood terror and pain. This hymn, "It Is Well With My Soul," was written after several traumatic events, one right after the other in Spafford's life. The first was the death of his son at age 4, which was followed by the Great Chicago Fire that completely obliterated his family business and ruined him financially. And just as he was getting out of that economic downturn, he had planned a visit to Europe with his family, and he had to stay behind for some business transactions. So he sent his wife and 4 daughters across to Europe, only to get from his wife this telegram, "Saved alone." As he learned that the vessel sank across the Atlantic as it collided with another vessel. And his 4 daughters were all killed. When he was traveling over the Atlantic to meet his wife, right at the very spot where that collision had taken place, he penned these words. "It is well with my soul." So as the band comes up, And as we do what Christians throughout the ages have done, pray to God in song. Let us affirm that in the chaos of life, it is still well with our soul.